Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Creative Control. Comedy, art, and sometimes rock and roll. Let's do a public opinion poll. Raise your hand if you love creative control. 'Cause when Vish is unleashed, well, you... Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. I was just working on a tribute song to my favorite podcast, Creative Control, with Vish Khanna. My name is Matthias, and I play in a band called The Burning Hell, but more importantly, I support Creative Control on Patreon, and I think you should too. Quality long-form arts journalism is like a magical talking unicorn. It definitely exists, but it can be really hard to find. Fortunately for us, Vish makes it easy with hundreds of funny, thought-provoking, well-researched, and engaging interviews with artists from all over the world. Your flexible monthly donation on Patreon will get you plenty of special exclusive treats and help Vish keep his podcast well-fed and cared for properly, the way a magical unicorn deserves.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Jason P. Woodbury is a musician, music journalist, songwriter, and podcaster based in Phoenix, Arizona. A critic who's been commissioned to write album liner notes, Woodbury is a regular contributor to the music outlet Aquarium Drunkard, where he does a few different things, including the weekly interview podcast Transmissions, where he's a host, as well as Range and Basin on Radio Free Aquarium Drunkard on Dublab, where he explores his love of things like comic books, science fiction, and mysticism. On September 9th, 2022, Fort Lowell Records released Something Happening, Always Happening, the debut album for Woodbury's musical alter ego, JPW. And after we connected when Jason invited me to be a guest on Transmissions, maybe a year ago or so, we got together again recently for this conversation where we discussed things like his time growing up in Arizona and how music reached him as a teenager, his entry point into music journalism and learning how to play guitar, his love of the Beatles and artists who write their own songs, engaging with interview subjects with a spirit of awe and enthusiasm, the powerful lull of the Sonoran Desert, and the alluring sound of JPW on this new record, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. This is a donor-driven podcast primarily, so thank you for supporting the show at patreon.com/creativecontrol. If you can, it's really appreciated. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with bricks and mortar locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and very friendly employees who will help you if you walk into one of their stores or if you use the internet sometimes. You go to blackbird.ca, say you want to order the JPW record that we're talking about today, Something Happening, Always Happening. Well, you go into their search box and you type all that stuff in, and if you're fortunate, and we're all fortunate, they can send you a copy of this album. They'll ship it to your house. If you're less fortunate, they may make you come to Edmonton or Calgary if you're not already there, because that's sometimes what happens. Anyway, you either pick it up in the store or they'll ship it to you. You figure it out. Learn more at blackbird.ca. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 780 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Jason P. Woodbury, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Jason. How's it going?
It's going fantastic.
That's good. That's good to hear. Where in the world are you?
I am in Phoenix, Arizona, in the Sonoran Desert, where I have lived for much of my life.
Yeah, that's where you're from there. Is that where you're like kind of raised as well? Is that where you're getting at?
I was raised, I spent the first few years of my life in a small suburb of Phoenix called Chandler, Arizona. And then my family moved further south to a town called Coolidge, Arizona, which is where I spent my youth kind of between Chandler and Coolidge. My mom lived in Chandler, and my dad's family lived in Coolidge. So that's where I spent most of my time. But yeah, kind of small town Arizona. And then I moved back up to the Phoenix metro area after high school or whatever. Yeah.
Well, any significant music interaction or arts and culture kind of interaction in the small towns?
In the small town? Coolidge?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, kind of in a certain way, because there wasn't much of a music scene in Coolidge, but there were a few older bands, some kind of punk dudes that I'm now, you know, talk with some of these guys who are maybe a few years older than me, but there were a few bands out of there. Kind of really well-known emo band Jimmy World once played a show down there. I did not make it to that show, but that was like a legend, you know, you'd hear about that.
Legendary show, yeah.
Yeah, so that happened. But I started playing music with friends, and, you know, a couple other kids did the same. And so we were kind of a three-band music scene or something like that, you know, staging generator shows in the desert and stuff like that, yeah.
So that's the local stuff. I guess where I was coming from in terms of, and I'm sorry if I missed this, how far away was Coolidge from Phoenix again?
Oh, it's about...
Is it? Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's...
it's not...
it's like a 45-minute drive up the 87. So it's not really that far. But in some ways, like, rural Arizona still feels like it's pretty far from Phoenix. And even, you know, Chandler, where I grew up, like I said, it's a suburb. So the music scene, especially in Phoenix, I mean, there were definitely bands. And I, when I was a kid, in particular, the Tempe scene sort of had started to blow up. So groups like the Gin Blossoms are like probably the most famous group. And so that music was super important to me. And as I've gotten older, I mean, I kind of feel like the Gin Blossoms are. White Fence did a cover of a Gin Blossom song for Aquarium Drunkard, Allison Road. And I think he really pinpoints just how much they sound like, you know, Big Star or the Birds, you know. So they kind of pointed me in that. The jangle pop stuff pointed me in that direction.
I see. So you, beyond the local stuff and the regional stuff, did you have opportunities to see bands when they would visit some of the bigger places?
Yeah, by the time I got into high school, I started to go to shows. Mostly, at that time, I would have been into like kind of punk and emo type stuff, I guess. So I would go see shows at a venue called The Nile in Mesa. And then as I got into more like indie rock stuff, there was a venue in downtown Phoenix called Modified Arts that was really important. And so, you know, around whatever, 2002, 2003, 2004, start getting into stuff like the Unicorns. I remember they had played there, and I saw The Good Life, which was like a cursive side project, you know, so stuff like that. So yeah, I started, eventually once I started going to shows, I mean, it was just like a foregone conclusion to me that I needed to move out of the small town and get to Phoenix so I could go to shows all the time. And so, yeah, that's what I did.
Nice. And so were you already playing music by the time you started seeing bands like those?
Yeah, basically started playing music when I was in, well, I mean, I played in like the school band, you know, so there was that. That was one side of it. I played clarinet in the school band, and I guess that was where I learned whatever I know of music theory, which is not, I don't know a lot, but my uncle and my dad would play, had played in their youth. And so my uncle had guitars everywhere and my dad had a bass and, you know, so I would kind of have access to that stuff. So yeah, I started kind of fiddling around with that in junior high. And then in high school, like everybody, I met a friend who had a guitar and I was like, we should start a band. And I could, I mean, I could barely play. And he wasn't much farther along. He knew, he figured out power chords. So that was like a revelation. But yeah, so
those are huge. He figured out some power chords? Yeah.
What was so funny is that this is my friend Zane, who plays on the JPW record. We've played together, I don't know, since like 1999 or something crazy. But I remember we would try to, we would learn songs, and I had like the Ramones anthology, and maybe, you know, we had like a Weezer, some Weezer tabs or whatever.
Yeah.
But I remember we would, I would be trying to play Ramones songs, but I didn't know power chords, so I was doing full chords, you know, full C chord, full D chord, full G, and I was like, it sounds correct but not right, like I don't understand what am I doing, you know. And
sorry, you're playing open chords or bar chords?
I was playing open chords.
Open chords, yeah.
Open chords. And so he showed up and he was like, hey, check it out, you don't even need all those fingers, man, you only need two fingers. And I was like, okay, cool. So that was sort of it. But yeah, you know, and what's funny though is that later, much later, once I had moved up to the valley is what we call it, and started working in a record store and started getting like really seriously into music, I realized that Coolidge, bizarrely enough, this kind of small rural Arizona town where I had grown up, had a crazy music history. Waylon Jennings was on the radio there just post the Buddy Holly stuff. Lee Hazelwood got his start on that same station. Duane Eddy, you know, the famous kind of surf pioneer, proto surf, you know, twangy guitar stuff. All those guys had lived in Coolidge. So I like kind of like later, I feel like I developed an intense connection to that music too, you know, and I felt like there was some connection there, you know, despite the fact that I certainly, that was many years before I was alive, that they were doing anything down there.
That is weird, though, because I grew up in a town called Cambridge, Ontario, and it's about an hour and 15 minutes from Toronto. And there was a rumor that started circulating in the late 80s that Guns N' Roses had played Cambridge at like this tiny restaurant bar thing. And, nice. and by the time the rumor circulated, it was because, and I was not a fan, by the way, but by the time I just want to clarify that it didn't excite me. But it was neat because sure. By the time the rumor circulated, they were quite huge. Appetite for Destruction had come out. And, I've thought about this because on the one hand, we were like, wow, they played the Highlands, that stupid restaurant near the hospital. Like, why would they have done that? And why didn't we know about it? I mean, we would have been too young as well to attend, but does that knowledge, what I've thought about it since is like, what did that even do? No one else yeah. ever played Cambridge. We would go to Waterloo or Kitchener or Toronto, wherever we had to go, Guelph, where I used to live, to see shows. People rarely, there were no venues in Cambridge, but at the same time, it felt kind of neat. So when you discover your the history of your area, does it impact you as a musician, as a fan of music?
I guess so. It must to some degree because, you know, Lee Hazlewood is one of my favorite musicians. And yeah. when Light in the Attic started their reissue
yeah.
campaign, for me, it was, I mean, I was such a huge fan of Light in the Attic. One of my kind of writing mentors, a guy named Chris Esty, who had written for a kind of smaller magazine that I was really obsessed with called Band Doppler magazine. They were kind of out of the Pacific Northwest and it was maybe loosely aligned with like a sort of Christian rock sensibility, a Christian mm-hmm. indie rock sensibility. Crindy is what some people will call it, you know, Christian indie rock. So I had sort of, he started working for Light in the Attic in their very early days when I remember one of the first times I ever got a package from a label as like a music writer was like a CD, the Black Angels Passover album and maybe an Alton Ellis release that they had done, you know, CD copies. So, but when Light in the Attic started their Lee Hazlewood reissue project, for me, I was working at an alt weekly here in Phoenix, the Phoenix New Times. And I was just so excited because it was like, this is awesome music that I am just obsessed with. I love Lee's sensibility. I love the weird romantic sweep of it. And obviously he made his most well-known records in LA and Sweden, you know, post Arizona, but nonetheless, I felt like there's a connection to it. And yeah. so I was able to connect with like, there's a local historian, John Dixon, who is essentially Arizona's premier music archivist. And so he had worked with Light in the Attic on that stuff, and he's, of course, worked with Numero Group and Bear Family and all of those labels, you know?
Yeah.
So I was able to connect with him and just start to, like, understand what he was doing and why it was important to him to preserve a regional thing. And so, yeah, I do think that however it works, all of that did kind of get into my head. And certainly, you know, one of the weird things about putting out a record after, you know, much more time writing about music or, you know, sort of talking to musicians, you know, to put something out yourself, you know, you do end up, so many people have referenced the desert-y qualities of the record. And I don't know, you know, it's definitely not any like choices, conscious decisions that I made, but yeah. I definitely think they're in there. And the producer, Michael Krasner, when I sent him some of the demos, he had associations, you know, to his youth on the Verde River in Arizona. He's like, this reminds me of this one Saturday afternoon. My friend had a Camaro and we took it to the lake. And I was like, that's so cool to me
yeah.
because I mean, I have no idea how that stuff got in there, but but it is in there for wherever it is. You know, where you come from shapes you, I think, very profoundly and very, if you're okay with that, or even if you're not okay with it, it happens, you know?
It's you. That's who you are. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah for sure.
So I appreciate all that background. I think you and I may share similar trajectories in that I think we entered... Sorry, I don't want to even speculate. I'll tell you where I'm coming from real briefly. And by the way, thanks again for having me on. the aquarium, the transmission show. That was
it was so much fun.
Many months ago. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it as well. So thank you so much for that. And we covered some of this ground there, and I'll link to that episode just in case people might have missed it, because it was it last year? Was it last year I was on the show? I think it was. The time is just blurry for me, but just thinking about our trajectories, in my case, got into music at a young age, listening, and then would devour all the media I could, and then started eventually figuring out, oh, I can try to play the music, played music in bands, made records, all that kind of stuff. And then in some ways, simultaneously started to enter freelance journalism, then college radio and broadcasting, then professional broadcasting, professional journalism, whatever those things mean. And now, you know, I'm in the middle of a couple of feelings and modes where as we're speaking, Jason, I just started embarking on an interesting recording project for the first time in a decade. And yet I'm probably most known for this podcast that I do, and whatever that means, most known. I put a lot of work into it, and so it is my primary, besides my day job and family stuff, it's my primary thing I do. But it is a weird realm. If I think about it, it's weird how I got here, and that intertwining player, fan, journalist, broadcaster. Is it safe to say you have a kind of similar trajectory? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, very much so. And I do think we talked about this a little bit on Transmissions. I guess when you're young, you don't know what you're doing, essentially. I mean, I was always pretty instinctual in terms of my actions, you know what I mean? And so I grew up with like kind of a collector mentality. I was into comic books. I was interested in, you know, science fiction. I was interested in stuff like that. And all of those things required kind of immersing yourself and figuring out what you are into and figuring out how to figure out what you're into, essentially, you know, like what that process looks like. And, well, I liked this, so maybe I would like this. And so I was primed for music taking hold the way it did. And yeah, in high school, I mean, it was just, I just became obsessed with listening to music and playing music and thinking about music, and even in high school, nascently writing about music.
Yeah, same here.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there was a school newspaper barely when I was in Coolidge, at Coolidge High School, but I signed up for the class, and for whatever reason, it had become, as I remember it, kind of like a screw around class. Like, people would sign up for it kind of knowing that they probably wouldn't have to do anything. And so that was sort of the deal, which was fine. I mean, I didn't know better, but once I got there, I was just sort of like, well, I really want to make the school newspaper. And I think there's like one other kid who contributed some articles, but basically I just started reviewing records for the school newspaper that barely existed, you know, just went anything.
That's the first thing I did, but it was counter programming. We didn't like the student council newspaper. So this guy, Jeff, and I decided we would do, it was called, the school mascot was a panther. So the, this is how contrary we were even at the end of high school. School mascot was a panther. The newspaper was called Cattails. And we thought we didn't like the student council popular kids that much. And so we called our thing cattle, as though they were herds of sheep or whatever. You know, we were very, had a lot of attitude. Yeah, that's the first. I remember I reviewed the Blues Explosion remix album that came out after Orange. And I wrote a review. That's the first thing I wrote a review of in my life, was high school, at the end of high school. But it was weirdly contrary, and there was a rebellious aspect to it. I didn't want to do it for the school paper. So, but yeah, I was so immersed in music journalism. And at that time, coming from a relatively small town too, that meant Rolling Stone, Spin, starting to find fanzines and things like that at that age. And that was eye-opening and empowering for me. And I gather you had a bit of that too, like you started to feel like, because that to me is that's what this music stuff is. It's like, I can do that. They're not superhuman. They're not gods. We can, and music journalism, you know, it's you can talk to people, you can interview people. Did you have that opening?
Very much. Yeah, yeah, very much so. I remember my mom got me a subscription to Spin, which was just like an absolute lifeline, yeah, you know, for yeah. me. It's easy now to kind of discount. I mean, that it was, of course, when it comes to alternative culture, I mean, Spin was sort of at the top of the heap, you know, I yeah. mean, in terms of its proximity to what was really popular or whatever. But no, I remember Spin was hugely important. I would read Rolling Stone. I would get alternative press. And then, yeah, you kind of start to tip your toes. I'd get to cooler record stores or bookstores, you know, stuff like Magnet, you know,
yeah,
or
yeah.
in those days, a lot more, you know, I would read Blender, you know, I'd read yeah. kind of whatever, like just anything. I almost had there was almost no filter on it. And then as the internet starts to become more of a thing, I mean, I do remember Pitchfork in the very early yeah. days. And I started writing for, I actually did a tiny bit of journalism for a web version of Bandoppler, the magazine that I mentioned earlier. That's where I got it. They let me write some stuff, and then Tiny Mixtapes,
oh, yeah.
which was a direct path to eventually writing for the Alt Weekly, eventually, you know, with Aquarium Drunkard, you know? Yeah, so, yeah. yeah.
How huge is that? Like, I grew up in high school reading Exclaim magazine, which is Canada's national free yeah. music magazine, and then I got to write for them. And, you know, I devoured Punk Planet, and there was a great zine called Filler that was based in Kitchener, Ontario, and they interviewed everybody that I'm still into today. So, yeah, it's interesting, our trajectories, because I was also, like I say, simultaneously trying to figure out how to play the drums, trying to figure out how to play guitar. Now we're both in a position where we have these podcasts that some people pay attention to. Do you ever wrestle with who you are? What am I doing? Because you've made this beautiful record. You seem very equipped. This JPW record that I'm referring to in particular, wonderful record. It's so gorgeous, and you seem very equipped. I gather you're something of a multi-instrumentalist at this point in your life, and you're playing a bunch of stuff, I think, and it's lovely. But do you wrestle with this a little bit? Like, who am I? What am I really doing, kind of thing?
Yeah, of course. I do wrestle with it. And I do, you know, for a long time, when I started getting into stuff, right? Like, so I finish high school. I do some community college, also in Central Arizona, where I was growing up. And I did that for a couple of years. I had a scholarship for my first 2 years because I'm going to be pretty frank. There wasn't a ton of competition for kind of like high GPAs in the Coolidge High School thing. So like almost everybody probably could have gone to the community college for free for a couple of years. Like I did.
See. Yeah.
But I kind of, while that was happening, was playing music, you know, and had moved out of my parents' house pretty young. I moved out on my own. I was 19, or I might have been 18 still. Regardless, it was pretty fresh, you know?
Yeah.
And I lived with people who I played music with. And so we would just play music until 2 a.m. And then I would go to school and work at a grocery store, you know, or for the health department a while. So writing about music, playing music, they were just happening at the same time for the most part, neither yeah. with a ton of success or recognition or particular skill, certainly in those days, but yeah. they were all happening at the same time. And then I moved up to Tempe, Arizona, which is where my grandparents, my mom's parents live. And so I actually lived just down the street from them and got a job at a record store and kind of still fooled around with school a little bit. But at that point, kind of started moving more in the direction of I'm going to play shows, I'm going to work in this record store, and I'm going to write about music. And I'll just do those things, you
yeah.
know, and I'll just do them all the time, maybe.
Yeah.
And I'll get better at them probably just by virtue of doing them. You know, that was I didn't have it so sketched out in my mind, that's for sure, but I did sort of have that sense. I know what I want to do, and it's this stuff.
Yeah.
And so I guess in a weird way, working in the record store, writing about music, those two fed into each other. Mm-hmm. Then you're playing music, and then that feeds into it. So you've got an ecosystem, an internal ecosystem in this weird way. And I didn't think much about it. I just was doing them all, you know? Mm-hmm. And then got a job at the Alt Weekly Phoenix New Times, which again, similar to your situation with Exclaim, like I read that as a kid, you know, and writers like Bob Mayer specifically, yeah, who I've had the pleasure of interviewing, you know, in my adulthood, but reading his stuff when I was younger was huge, you know, and people like, there's a critic named Serene Dominic who was really important, and these guys were, yeah. So I start working there, and then just the natural thing of life sort of starts happening a little bit. Maybe a couple bandmates move away or somebody graduates college and gets a job. And now, well, the drummer's gone and you join another band, but that band doesn't have the same drive as the previous. And then kind of in a weird way, I found myself for a decade or so just not really playing music, you know, still doing it every now and then for fun, yeah, certainly always doing it on my own, getting together with buddies and play a show every couple of years, things like that. But, you know, at this point, it feels so boring and passé to talk about the pandemic to some degree. But I can't deny the fact that when all of a sudden things shifted and changed and the lockdowns sort of went into effect, I mean, I found myself with a lot more bandwidth, you know, and the podcast transmissions, which I had been doing for years with the Aquarium Drunkard, we locked into a groove and things felt super good. And we took the show weekly, and all of a sudden that started to sort of, you know, snowball in terms of just how good it felt. And we were doing the Radio Free Aquarium Drunkard stuff in those days, which was we still do as a monthly broadcast on Dublab, but in the early days of the pandemic, I mean, launched a 24-hour pirate radio stream online, you know, and people all over the world were listening. And so I think that open space and this feeling of a sort of, I mean, probably certainly a huge amount of fear about the state of the world and a huge amount of anxiety about various things and all of that. But also I think, for me, at least in those early days, I had a real sense of optimism that this was going to sort of change the way people think about our relationship to each other, our relationship in community, our relationship to art. I mean, everybody I know in those days was listening to music. And I remember people saying, you know, oh, I've been getting out CDs that I hadn't listened to in years and years. Or, oh, I went and was looking through all these records that I had amassed and never even listened to. So I had this feeling, and the degree to which that took hold societally, maybe not what I thought it might be, but on a personal level, something shifted and unlocked and changed. And I had been in the process of getting ready to make a record with my friends in the group Kitimoto, and we had done a bunch of practices, and towards the end of 2020, we did a session, you know, when there was the first sort of like, I think it's maybe safe to do stuff again. And then immediately it became clear that it wasn't safe to do stuff again. Yeah. So then a couple months later, you know, we finished that record. But finished that record and then just rolled right into making this one. And it just, for me, you know, I guess you, because you asked like, do I ask myself, you know, who am I? What am I? What, you know, I do. Yeah. And I did. And I was nervous about putting music out into the world. I was really nervous and a little hung up on the idea that it's hard to even say what it was. It's like a combination of anxieties and stresses and fears and nervousness, you know, like, are people going to think that I am saying that I'm worthy of putting out a record?
Yeah.
It sounds like a ridiculous notion.
No,
but it did.
I'm going
my head.
I'm going through it right now. I'm doing the same thing as you, and engaging in a long distance project. And it's a very weird approach to it. And we're still kind of operating. It's all very remote. It's all meant to be a remote project with remote collaboration. And I've had the same thoughts. Like, just given the primary collaborator I'm working with, I'm like, this is out of my league, but they seem into it and they're encouraging me. And I'm sure you've been encouraged as well.
No, 100%. My collaborator, my main collaborator on Something Happening, Always Happening is Michael Krasner, who is from a group called Boxhead Ensemble, and he had also played under the name Lofty Pillars, and he's done a bunch of his own work. He did this really incredible score for a Universal Soldier movie, which was like, I don't know, came out about a decade ago, and it was this art house. It's very upsetting, very graphic, but also really good. Sort of, if A24 had existed when this was coming out, I honestly think it could feel like an A24 movie. You could call it like an elevated genre thing. But so Krasner has just, and he's worked with, I mean, people, Jim O'Rourke and Will Oldham, these people who, my wildest, most self-inflated moments would never dare to think of myself in relation to in musical, you know, capacities at all, right? So, but he was, yeah, super encouraging. And also, I discovered a side of myself that was more encouraging and kind to myself that I hadn't been in touch with, you know? Yeah. And that was maybe Krasner and Zane and my friend Zach Toporek, who's on the record, you know, these guys were so deeply kind and encouraging and excited. They were excited by what I was bringing to the table. They were like, no, this is cool. This is something that is worth us, you know, putting our time into. And in the weirdest way, a few of the songs came together in the very, very start. It really did feel like that, like maybe a block or something that had been in front of my subconscious or unconscious mind had lifted, whatever it was. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's getting a little older. Maybe it's facing a strange future. Maybe it's realizing on some level, well, if you want to do this, you might not have an infinite amount of time to do things. You know what I mean?
Sorry, so it's like these realizations are pandemic. Since the beginning of the pandemic, you've had these.
Or maybe a little bit more of a recognition of that stuff that you probably that I knew instinctually, or obviously we all know these things on some level. But yeah, no, the strangeness of the situation pulled it into focus in a new way.
Among the things that have been affected by this collective experience, I think, are everyone's relationship with time and also what's important. So when I earlier asked you if you pose such questions to yourself like I do, like, what am I doing? Who am I really? I didn't expect you to have answers to those. There aren't any real answers to those. We're dynamic people, human beings. So I think what I'm also picking up on and I can relate to is I'm just doing things. I'm just doing the things that seem right and are in front of me. And if that means I'm making a podcast right now, and that also means I'm making music right now or writing about music or whatever, they all are complementary. And you use the word feed into each other. And the one thing that sparked for me is I wonder if you can relate to the notion that they might actually be informing one another. Now, I know some people might be like, why would interviewing someone or writing about music, how could that inform you as a player or as a composer yourself? And I've thought about that with all the different hats I've worn, from the stuff I've already described, journalism and performance and recording. I've also wound up emceeing / stagehanding, being a stagehand at music festivals, and being on, I've never run a label, but being on like juries. I've just been so immersed in various aspects of the industry by accident, like the traditional music, putting on shows. Like that's a whole other skill set and a level of work, planning events. But for some reason, I've done it. And it's just because someone had to do it. And I happened to be the one who stepped up at that point. And I've tried to slow things down. All I'm getting at is, and my question for you really is, beyond feeding into one another, do you feel like all the different things you do actually practically, tangibly inform everything you're doing?
Yeah, I do. I do think that they do. And I think that the things that a person does the things that a person truly immerses themselves in can't help but inform what comes out. I love the Beatles. The Beatles are one of my favorite bands, right?
Yeah, I got the two. I got the vinyl and the mono box set up there, and I got them on compact disc, and my first love.
There you go. Me too. And they were, I mean, hearing the Beatles, I didn't actually grow up in a Beatles household. That wasn't my mom and dad's music. My mom was more into like Tesla. My dad more into Boston. So, you know, not Beatles people necessarily.
You know what I'll tell you real quick about that, though, is I would mostly agree with you on, or rather, I can relate to you with that. However, I will tell you that my parents immigrated to Canada from India. So when I got into the Beatles, they're like, oh, do you know the Beatles came to India? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was significant. The same way you were talking about bands coming through town and making your place feel like it was worth them doing that, and that made the place feel more special. My parents would talk quite, well, my mother mostly, my dad didn't say too much about it, but my mother was like, spoke of them fondly, that they would take the time and immerse themselves in Indian culture and spiritual practice. Except maybe she didn't know how much Ringo didn't like it. But my point is,
he wasn't into the food.
No, he wanted
right?
to go home, and he split as early as he could. That's Ringo. But my point is, I just want to say, like, I would often ask my parents to play the music that my cousin got me into or whatever is on the radio if I could buy a Fine Young Cannibals tape or whatever the heck I had in excess.
Yeah.
They would tolerate that, but when we would go on drives across the highway to visit my mom's relatives about an hour away, frequently, like almost twice a month, we would make those trips and we would listen to music and they would play some of their music, but they always liked the Beatles. And I now can't help but think that fondness comes from the fact that, yeah, those are the guys who came. And I mean, God, you put on Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, there's sitar on it. Like, what do you... They were just like, this is... It was like we were kind of communing over them. So, sorry for my extended...
No.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's beautiful. Yeah. I bring up the Beatles to sort of like make the point that the Beatles set the template for what a rock band should be. Something that they didn't intend to do, but I think happened as a result of the Beatles, though also, was this emphasis placed on sort of authorship and individual creative capacity.
Yeah.
And I guess what I mean to say is, like, before that, you know, you get like an Elvis or whatever, and Elvis was not a songwriter. No. You know, Elvis was an interpreter of songs.
Yeah.
Sinatra was an interpreter of songs. You know, you can look at parts of Scott Walker's career where Scott Walker is not... He's not acting as a songwriter. He's a singer, you know? And that wasn't viewed as sort of invalid. And then in the post-Beatles age, there's this idea that like a songwriter, a rock songwriter, you know, is this person who's creating this original thing that is not, you know. And I get it and I love, and there's parts of that that are just so true and I do get. But I also think that Our creativity is the result of synthesis and is the result of hearing things that resonate on very deep levels and taking things into our imaginal capacities and running them through the filter that is us, you know, and producing something from that. Just the same way that I can say that where I'm from got into the music, you know, so has hearing the Velvet Underground on a bus trip, you know, to Flagstaff when I was a kid, you know, sophomore year, putting the 20th Century Masters Velvet's CD on my Walkman and hearing the first few songs and being like, this is kind of cool. And then getting to Heroin and being like, you know, the Big Bang, right, in your head that takes place. Yeah, that got into me on some level that I'll never, ever, ever be able to untangle it from the part of my brain that says, now we're going to make a song, you know? So I do think that, like, you brought up our relationship with time, and to me, maybe that's part of what's happened since I've really given myself permission to play music again and to engage in that. Was I was taken by the way music can bend time and the way I can be transported back into my own biography, into, you know, whatever, by hearing a song. And so I think that really what happened for me was once playing music started giving me some related feeling to the magic that I had experienced listening to music, you know, which wasn't always, I always was electrified by playing music. I always loved playing music. I was always engaged in it, and it always was a thrill. But all of a sudden, I was making songs that didn't feel the same way that previous songs had to me, or some part of me had let a guard down that I was like, well, I want to make this. And I think the rule is that if you feel like this making it, if it's scratching an itch for you on a personal level, there is a chance that it could do that for somebody else in some way. And to recognize that that's not about your ego and that's not about any of those other things that I'd been worried about or hung up on was a freeing thing. And so, yeah, once that happened, it was like, I think I have to put stuff out because I want to reciprocate, you know, whatever that means. I don't know what it means, but it is, yeah, I'm just going with my gut instinct on it.
Well, it's in our work as interviewers, it's just an interesting time, I think, for the kinds of the kind of journalism that has been adopted via podcasting, which is the sort of, in my case, I am having, and as this one, as just as we're having right now, they're free-form conversations that, for me anyway, have a purpose. And I'm trying to get to people's work and their approach to stuff. But it where you can get lost, and on in my lowest skill set here, where I get lost is where I want to relate to my guest, who I don't know often. Often they're strangers to me. And sometimes if I think on it, I'm like, yeah, I play drums. And I'm like, why am I putting that out there? How does that inform the conversation? And I think it's because I want to be like, yeah, I can relate to what you're doing. I've made records. I've gone on tour. I've done some comedy. I've written things. And I guess I just wonder if you're ever conscious of that. Because I appreciate everything you're saying and the thoughtfulness of like, why would I put out a record? Who's going to want that? Is it weird to do it if I'm known maybe more for one thing to then throw my hat into the ring? And for me, I'm sensitive to it because I've written some negative reviews of music over the years because I've had to. And who
As
am
if I?
Yeah. Who am I to say anything once I put out something and someone slags it, you know? Anyway.
Yeah.
My point is, do you ever get that level of self-conscious of like, am I trying to put myself too much into the conversation in an effort to relate to this guest I admire or whose work I look up to? Because you kind of want to find some, if I think on it, I reach out to people because I like them, but a lot of these kinds of conversations are trying to find some kinship in the moment. Quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you relate to any of that?
I do, and I think that my own musical practice has not come up on the podcast very often, right? Yeah. You know, like I don't always volunteer it, and I guess I am somewhat conscious of that because as the host, it's a complicated untangling, right? Because you know, it's similar to what I'm saying about music.
Yeah.
When I feel the song on an emotional level, I believe that's because I've poured enough of myself into the song that it has some spark of humanity, and that's what a listener will hear, maybe, you know, or not.
Yeah.
But that's what I hear when I love a song, is I'm hearing some distilled expression of an individual or a group of individuals or a scene of whatever it is. And so I do think that in the podcast and when I'm talking to people for Aquarium Drunkard or for Wastoids, which is another project I do with my friend Sam and we'd do a show where we just talk to each other, and it's similar with him, and it's similar with the different guests on Transmissions, is like, I am trying to get myself into a state of enthusiasm for the conversation.
Yeah.
That it's resonating with me on an emotional or spiritual or creative level, you know? So, and I do believe that as a host, you have to put enough of yourself into the thing that a listener is not just there for the guest. They're also at least partially there for me. And I try to maintain, again, this is usually done instinctually and without really planning or thinking too much. I mean, I think you relate very much to that too.
Yeah.
Because you can't overthink it, or you get in a different kind of weeds. But
yeah.
But I do think that it's like, okay, I'm here to be enthusiastic and curious and excited for the listener too. Like I'm going to bring that energy to this. And I hope that by expressing that through my own side of the conversation, I hope that I'm creating the space for the listener to then feel that as well. Because, you know, I've been really obsessed, Vish, lately I've been obsessed with Douglas Rushkoff's podcast, Team Human.
Oh.
And I like how he keeps talking about cultivating awe as not just like a good thing to do, but maybe like a survival tactic, you know, to just sort of like always remain open to awe and wonder and excitement. And if I've done anything good with Aquarium Drunker Transmissions, I think it's trying to maintain a root connection to my own enthusiasm for the idea of songs and music and art and expression and creative stuff. So I think that's like, it's like I try to keep something like a beginner's mind in terms of the conversations. I try to ask questions as they come naturally, driven by my own enthusiasms. And I do think that in a weird way, that's, you got to pour yourself into the vessel so that it has some humanity to it. And I think guests resonate with that. And I definitely think that listeners, when it works, they resonate.
I hope so.
I think so.
I hope so. And I'm from my perspective, I think you and I have pretty similar approaches to how we do things. And
similar guest lists, as we've discussed in the past, every now and then.
Yes, and I think that's great. I mean, I think that we...
Me too.
There's a little bit of podcast kinship that's developing among... I feel like I'm part of a small community of people
who
are like-minded. And that to me is like the same way... I was just talking to someone this morning about... we were talking about a different artist and how they're both on tour at the same time. So they keep seeing each other's posters at the same venues. Yeah. And on some level, when we launch our podcasts we get our notifications, it's kind of like the same thing. Oh, Transmissions is in town. And well, who do they got going on? You know? So I appreciate that. And I am also not trying to overthink too much, but with this pandemic, there's been a lot to overthink. And also, I don't know, I picked up guitar more. I played more guitar. A lot of people have told me, well, I took up an instrument. I've tried to use this time to enhance something or get to something I haven't been able to get to before. And of course, some of that is waning now. But all this to say, I appreciate these insights. This record of yours, like I say, is really wonderful. And you were talking about people picking up on desert themes. My wife, when she first heard some of the scorching guitar, was like, this kind of reminds me of like Nels Klein or someone. I'm like, whoa, that's a pretty big compliment. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the sound and also maybe some of the lyrical motifs. You talked about this seismic shift that you've undergone and you've experienced. and I assume that's informed some of this songwriting, which I think is both, it's pleasant but pensive. I'll put it that way. I feel like there's something looming there. But
that's awesome to hear.
Can you talk a little bit about what motivated both the sound and maybe some of the lyrics on this JPW record?
Yeah, I think a lot of the sound, you know, most of these songs started as me, you know, by myself with either a drum machine and a bass or guitar. And in some ways, I was worried that they felt a little grab baggy. They didn't all fit exactly into the same sort of genre, right? But I had enough of a sense of the shape of it to just sort of like, okay, let's just start fleshing this stuff out and letting it go. So some of the stuff is done almost entirely on my own, but a lot of it was done in collaboration with Michael Krasner, yeah. who is, for like a full disclosure's sake, like most of the good guitar playing on this record is him.
Okay.
I say that only, I mean, I say that half joking. I play a lot of guitar on the record too. And I am very, I like playing guitar yeah. an awful lot. And so I had a lot of fun with this one. And there's some moments that are definitely me, but he brought so much to the proceedings, and he plays the piano on the record as well. And both of those things, you know, we would have these conversations. I make Range and Basin, which is the Dub Lab radio show on Radio Free Aquarium Drunkard. We make that together as well. And he brought a kind of selflessness to his playing where his, and this is a guy who does the same thing on records with Caliphone.
Yep.
You know, him and Tim they go way back, and he does it with pretty much everybody he works with. He's listening for what it needs to sprinkle on there and take it to the next level. And so his sort of twangy, lonesome guitar just started to inform the foundation of the record, which is this sort of mid-century, that's a thing that I definitely like this feel, right? The sort of desert evoking twang music of somebody like Duane Eddy, who I brought up. And I think that kind of guitar style certainly has fed into the Nels Klein stream, you know, but yeah. also Krasner's a dude with Chicago roots as well.
Oh, wow.
So he's pulling from that. He's like, I mean, Jeff Tweedy's been on his records in Glenn early days,
yeah.
you know, so there's crossover there.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
But I do think that's a big part of it. And it's obviously, I mean, Wilco is one of those bands where it's just like, it's a foundational band for me.
Are they?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's something that's in there. But then I also think there are other little things that don't exactly do that exact same thing on the record. And Cruel in Time is an example where, I mean, in my head, I was trying to make something that sounded like Suicide, and
yeah,
it
no, that's so weird. That's exactly what I hear that. I hear bits of Pavement though too. Sometimes, like, I hear all sorts of things.
You definitely hear Pavement for sure. The Kitimoto record as well. That's one where John, who's the singer songwriter in that band, and the other guys, we are all. Pavement's like one of our, you know, where we all meet in the middle kind of influences. So that's definitely in there. But yeah, so that's sort of a little bit about the sound. And then I wanted it to be weird and spacey at moments. And the final track being built on this Lenny Kaye sample that talk about somebody, by the way, who has written about music, who has performed music, who has assembled records, you know, all the stuff. Yeah. He's a shining light in that regard. But so I wanted it to get psychedelic at moments. I wanted it to feel kind of funny every now and then. Like Wealth of the Canyon is kind of the single, mm-hmm. and that's built on this great JJ Cale-ish kind of thing that Krasner had cooked up, and then I did kind of improvised falsetto vocals over, and we shaped that into a thing. But there's this one part where Zach and I were working on it in his studio, Zach Toporek, who plays under the name Dadweed, and we play together a lot now. But I was like, this part where there's an eagle in the song, it would be funny if we had like a really overt eagle screech in it.
Right.
And so we like went on YouTube and found it, and then we just like dunked it in reverb, and we were like, yes, that's so funny. and it was silly though, too. You know what I mean? So I was like, I don't want it to always be... I knew from my own, from knowing myself, that it could be ponderous and portentous if I'm not too careful. You know what I mean? So it's like, I want to be funny too. And I want to have some elements that just point to the sort of joy and fun we're having, but then I want it to be spooky, and I don't like when music is just one thing.
No, and
you know what I mean?
You've definitely accomplished that. Like, I feel like there's lots of charm to it, as much as I'm left wondering what's happening kind of thing, you know? That's, you've hit a,
that's great.
You've hit a real sweet spot there. So, yeah, I just wanted to say, I appreciate this. This was a surprise to me when you sent me this news that you made a record. I wasn't totally sure that that's something you did a lot of. So I appreciate it. Why, by the way, why JPW? Why not your full name?
You know, that's a great question that I don't have a particularly good answer for. I know that one of my hot takes, Vish, this will get me canceled on Twitter. No, I'm just kidding. It won't really.
Okay.
I don't like band. I hate every band name that I've ever been a part of, or for the most part, right? Like, I just, to me, I've been in bands that have cooler names, but anytime I've ever had to come up with one, I've just found myself unsatisfied and dissatisfied, and just like, I couldn't. There's something about it that just really gets me and bugs me for whatever reason.
Sure.
And so I had ideas, and I thought, well, maybe just put it out as Jason P. Woodbury. And then I was like, Jason P. Woodbury, that sounds like a writer's name. I don't know why this was happening
okay.
in my head.
No, that's fine. I'm already pondering. I'm going to say that this is Jason P. Woodbury on the show, not JPW. I find that too vague. Is that okay?
No, absolutely.
Okay.
JPW is my name. But when it comes to the music, I guess what I wanted was just a tiny bit of distance, right?
Yeah.
Like I wanted people to be able to understand to you can file this one in this bucket, right? If it says JPW on it, that means he's doing music. And the other thing was, I'm a huge fan of ELO, the band, and I'm a huge fan of when prog bands will just be everybody's last name,
right?
You know, like ELP, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, or you know, whatever else.
Sure.
So in my goofy stoned imagination or whatever, I was thinking JPW is like a prog initials thing. But it's, all of this is to say, I also thought it would just look kind of cool on a sticker.
Yeah.
And that was, and that's what we did on the cover of the record, was just that yellow sticker that says JPW. And I was like, for whatever reason, it was just a weird, I don't know.
No, I appreciate that. So it was graphically inspired. It was to give yourself a little bit of mystery, maybe.
Maybe.
And also separated from maybe what your name is maybe known for these days.
Yeah.
All right, I appreciate that. Now, if people want to learn, I have a couple of questions here. Can you tell us a little bit about your future plans, whether there's touring or more recordings coming up? And also within that, if people want to learn more about such things, where they can go to learn more about JPW, this record, and anything else you want them to follow you, those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, on the sort of musical front, Kirimoto has been playing shows, JPW, and my friend Zach, his combo Dadweed. We've been doing these sort of combined shows where he's got a record out called High Time, and we've just always been really close buddies for a long time now. So we're at that point where it's like we want to play music and we want to have friends contribute, but managing bands is tough and can be very tough. So we hatched this idea of just sort of like, well, let's have a band. We'll call it JPW and Dadweed, or Dadweed and JPW, and we'll do some songs from his record. We'll do some songs from my record. And then we made a whole record together
we're just about done with.
And it's a 50-50 duo project. And so we'll play some songs from that. So we've got some shows coming up. Check Twitter or whatever. Yeah, you can just check, you know, for updates. But yeah, so Dadweed and JPW are playing shows. I'm doing lots of stuff with Wastoids, which is the project I do with Sam Means. We make podcasts and we make videos, and we're doing some really, really fun stuff that I'm obsessed with some of the people we're working with right now. Documa, which is Bobby Marcos from the band Cloakroom. We're working on some projects.
Oh, nice.
Salvador Cresta, who is this really amazing Argentinian video director. He makes a show for Wastoid, so I just have a huge, having
very
so
busy.
Much fun doing
You're
that.
A busy guy. Yeah.
Very, very busy. Yeah. And then, of course, Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. Yeah. We do that every week, and we've got just so many great talks coming up I'm just over the moon about some of the people who have been hanging out on the show, and I love making that show.
Yeah.
And I think I said this when we talked, but really, your show remains an inspiration for me and has been an inspiration, and was one of those things that really helped me remember, like, hey, I could do this.
Great.
We could put ourselves out there. We could, you know. And to me, your show is just a beautiful example of that DIY ethic and creativity at work. So it really means a lot to be on Creative Control.
That's too kind, Jason, and it's greatly appreciated. and I'll say the feeling's mutual. It is meaningful to me to know that you're out there. I think seeing my peers and like-minded colleagues doing things is, when I'm feeling low, it's motivational. It helps me to be like, no, I'm not alone doing this. And there is a point to this and all those sorts of questions that sometimes pop up when you're, for me, it's always like, okay, I've got everyone booked for the month I'm in. Got to do it all over again the next month. Who am I going to get?
I know.
How am I going to figure this out? And it's a lot. But enough about me. I just want to say thank you for the kind words, and the feeling is mutual. So thank you for all the things you're doing. If we can go out on a song from this JPW record, I wondered if you can pick one for us and tell us why you chose it.
You know, I think it would be cool to go out on Something Happening, the first track from it.
Okay.
And maybe the reason why I'd pick that one is because it just, I love the way Zach's drums sound. We tracked two different drum kits for that, and he is like one of the most precise and like intensely technical players I've ever worked with, and it was so much fun to tell him to be sloppier and looser and have him be like, oh, I'll give it a shot, and I was like, looser, and then we'd do another take, and we got it just sounding so shambolic. To me, that one is just like, I always get I get a kick out of hearing those drums, and I'm such a fan of listening to him play them. So that's the one I'd pick.
All right, well, this is sort of the half title track from the new album Something Happening Always Happening by JPW. This is track one. This is Something Happening. Jason, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for making time for me. I hope you enjoyed yourself, and best of luck
immensely.
In the future.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's very nice to reconnect with Jason P. Woodbury there. I haven't talked to him really since we... had our talk for his show Transmissions. Very nice of Jason to be on this, the 780th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available just about wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, you can do all of those things, ideally, I think, at my website there. Just visit vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook. There's a page still up and running. You can also follow the show for now on Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to support this donor-driven podcast. $6 American or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, get episodes earlier than everybody else. You get some bonus stuff, content that no one else gets. And also, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon. And if I don't get some more messages about these t-shirts, I'm burning them. I've had these t-shirts a long time. Some of them, it fits and starts. Every once in a while, I'll get three orders. And I'm like, what happened? And then nothing. And then so they just sit there, down there in the basement, wondering what the hell I'm doing up here. And I go down and I talk to them, because I'm losing my mind. And I say, yeah, it's all right, t-shirt's not your fault. Don't worry. There'll be orders soon. Just relax. And see, I'm losing it. Anyway, I want to thank you for your support of the show on Patreon, and I'd like to send you a t-shirt and get them out of my house. Learn more at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to the wonderful Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, but also a website where you can order records and they'll mail them to you if it's possible, if they can get them. You'll learn more at blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks as always to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music that he made himself and then loans to me. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with JPW, Jason P. Woodbury. Thanks again to Jason. I hope you enjoyed this chat, those of you listening right now to me speaking. If you didn't know Jason's work, I hope you'll check it out. And otherwise, I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast or follow it and tell your friends all about it, and maybe they'll do the same things and help spread the word about Creative Control. All right, I'm going to leave you now, but I will talk to you very soon. Thank you. Be well. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.